Now, I'm delighted to introduce a man whose very vocation curiously spans both kingdoms. Here is a journalist of the First Order who has really is putting out fantastic product, Christianity Today, and the other magazines published by his publishing house. And, of course, the focus is the right-hand kingdom, but not exclusively. So who would be better equipped to respond to the apple tree question than David Neff, editor-in-chief of Christianity Today? David.
Of all the disillusionments and debunkings I have had to face as a Christian, this is nowhere near the most earth-shaking. If Martin Luther did not say, "If the world were to end tomorrow, I would plant an apple tree today," my Christian faith will not be seriously damaged. But I will admit, I am disappointed. Luther's apocryphal aphorism was so handy, so pithy, so parabolic. Yet Professor Rosin has, in his own engaging style, rearticulated the fundamental ideas and once again fastened them firmly to the historical Luther. Dr. Rosin has my gratitude. I am struck by the apocalyptic context of this theology of work. The apocryphal quote itself comes from a time, as he said, when the world was crashing down around the people that the pastor was trying to reach. And we easily forget that the years of Luther's ministry were pervaded by an apocalypticism all through the social consciousness. Yet we need to look no further than some of the better-known follies of the Radical Reformation to be reminded of it. The ravings of the Munster prophets, the egoistic enthusiasm of Thomas Munzer, these things did not happen in isolation, but sprung from their time. Indeed, even without the radicals, the seeming shaking of the religious and epistemological and cultural foundations created their own eschatological sense. So this theology of work must be appreciated in the context of apocalyptic expectations. And its message is essentially anti-apocalyptic. As I was able to read a few days ago Dr. Rosin's draft, I was reminded of a little book that shaped my theology of work back in the 1970s. The 1970s, you will remember, was when the innovations of the 1960s actually permeated American culture. The 60s, too, were an apocalyptic times of sorts. At the very least, the old order seemed to be passing, and young musical prophets were telling us that the times, they were a-changing, and that the answer, my friend, was blowing in the wind. The book that helped me to think about work back then was not written by a Lutheran, but it was also written in response to an apocalyptic mood. And this points up the need for us to do the work of theologizing about vocation in every particular time of turmoil. Quaker philosopher D. Elton Trueblood wrote his book, The Common Ventures of Life, in the glare of the atomic bomb. He perceived that his students at Earlham College no longer had the ambition to pursue a life's work, a vocation. Thanks to what we just used to call the bomb, thanks to the bomb, they could not see a future in which their work could be meaningful, could add up to something. The future they saw was seriously demotivating. Now, before we get to what Trueblood said about work, it is important, however, to understand the fundamental thrust of his book. First delivered as a series of lectures at Southwestern University in 1948, The Common Ventures of Life was then published in book form by Harper in 1949. And in it, Trueblood addressed not only work, but three other common ventures. The four of them taken together are birth, marriage, work, and death. What he wanted to say about all of these is that they are not merely incidental events in our earthly lives as we prepare for heaven. No, he said, the Bible is a highly materialistic book. Christian revelation happened through mundane historical process. in particular times and in particular places. Christianity is committed to believe in the ultimate significance of this historical process rather than to a set of ideas independent of events. Having rooted Christian faith in creation and history, Trueblood moved on to affirm the wholeness of man, holding together the bodily and the spiritual, and to criticize the church for tending to spiritualize and abstract. He moved from there to call for an application of, quote, our central conviction that religion is not something separate from ordinary life, but a divine frame into which all ordinary events can be placed. Secularization, he argued, fragments life. On the other hand, Christian faith, properly understood, unites life, makes it whole, connects its various parts with palpable sinews. So what did Trueblood say about work to his students who were apocalyptically depressed by the bomb? And what did he say to my age mates who were apocalyptically disoriented by rapid social change in the 60s? First, he said, avoid the interim mentality. Avoid fatalism. Avoid the mood of futility. The bomb, which could be dropped at any time, created a paralysis as we became a people waiting for catastrophe. The interim mentality by which we now live, he wrote, is bound to destroy us if it continues long. The most beneficent form which this reaction can take is the decision to organize our lives as though they are to go on, and thus to make the fundamental wager. Now, if only Luther had made the remark about planting an apple tree, it would have been much more succinct, but it couldn't have been any more on target. Fatalism, said Trueblood, quoting Thucydides, tends to produce what it dreads, for men do not oppose that which they consider inevitable. Second, Trueblood joined Luther in extending the notion of vocation beyond clerical orders to the laity. Trueblood is critical of talking about full-time Christian service when we mean professionalized Christian service. If ours is God's world, Trueblood wrote, any true work for the improvement of man's life is a sacred task and should be undertaken with this aspect in mind. The really crucial decision comes not when a person decides to be a foreign missionary rather than a farmer. The really crucial decision comes when a man decides that he will live his whole life in what the late Thomas Kelly called holy obedience. Whether that leads to farming or banking or evangelistic work in Africa is then wholly secondary. Trueblood thinks, Quaker that he was, that ordination should be for all vocations and not simply for clerical callings. Part of our trouble is that we have so often left the religious job to those who are supposed to be professionally religious. But decline comes this way. The task is far too large for any one group, no matter how deeply dedicated and able they may be. The idea of being professionally religious is really a pernicious idea anyway, because of the degree to which it seems to excuse the rank and file of a solemn sense of responsibility. Nobody can have my religion for me any more than they can have my health for me. As a philosopher, Trueblood went on to explore how work contributes to human happiness, and in step with his times, he complained of the alienation that comes from work on the production line and the impetus to consumerism which results from a loss of satisfaction with work. But ironically, contemporary Americans clamor for these industrial jobs to return to our economy. For whatever they lacked in meaning, they were able to make up for in job stability. Now we worry about jobs being exported to the maquiladoras in places like Juarez, and we seem to have created a generation of baristas in our cities. The struggle for meaning is intensified. September 11, 2001, briefly renewed our apocalyptic mood, but I'm not convinced that it has lasted, as the ill-defined war on terror has dragged on and the American public has become more annoyed than outraged. Our hypermodernism, with our lack of coherence and our focus on the self, leads us to a state of perpetual annoyance and a lack of hope, a lack of significance. All this because we live in a culture of entertainment, I think. But even without an apocalyptic mood, we still have with us the interim mentality and the mood of futility which Trueblood warned against. The secularist fragmentation of life also continues, and it is within the resources of Christian theology of work to restore wholeness, to bring together the strands of life, its common ventures in a singular Christian fabric. I believe that Luther, Lutherans, and Lutheranism bring much to our current situation. Your community seems to be a place for us to turn. But to what degree are Lutherans engaging with the larger Christian community in its attempts to place contemporary work in a Christian frame? And to what extent is the larger Christian community looking to Lutherans for help? Not nearly enough, I would say. Luther is clearly the threshold thinker who stands between a cramped medieval vision of vocation and a comprehensive Christian vision of vocation. But his insights were taken up and applied in notable ways by others, Puritans, Wesleyans, Dutch Calvinists, and yes, even Quakers, and Catholics too. In 1998, my wife and I attended the 20th anniversary celebration of the Chicago-based Roman Catholic organization called the National Center for the Laity. One of the plenary speakers for this event was the Lutheran business executive and writer William E. Deal, author of Thank God It's Monday. Deal's talk was not particularly memorable, since what he set forth were the simple outlines of a classic Lutheran understanding of vocation. But the response of the Catholic audience was as though it was a revelation to them. Ideas more than 400 years old were finally beginning to sink in. Mark Knoll and Carol Nystrom's book asked, "Is the Reformation over?" I suggest, at least from the responses we heard at the National Center for the Laity Conference, that the Reformation is only beginning to have an impact in the area of vocation. Lutherans like Deal, who are willing to work ecumenically, can play an important role. In preparing for this response, I took off my shelf Gil Melander's volume entitled Working, Its Meaning and Limits, published in 2000. It's a collection of source materials on work that has given Gil Melander's work context at Valparaiso remarkably free of Lutheran matter. Perhaps his editor's powers of selection are guided by a Lutheran sensibility, but Lutheran writers are notably missing from this volume. There are, however, numerous thinkers from other traditions, Roman Catholics, led by the likes of Michael Novak, Charles Taylor, Joseph Pieper. They dominate the list, with Reformed and Presbyterian thinkers coming in a close second. Then there's the Yale Center for Faith and Culture, which has a minimal Lutheran influence. On staff is Christian Sharon, an ELCA minister, but the center's guiding light is its Presbyterian director, David W. Miller. Watch for his forthcoming book, God at Work, from Oxford University Press, coming in January. So far, I've only flipped through the bibliography and begun to read Chapter 5, but which traces the response of church and academy to contemporary faith at work movement. But I'm already sensing a Lutheran absence. And the bibliography on the faith and business site on David Miller's website cites only one Lutheran source, Bill Deal's classic Thank God It's Monday. By way of contrast, that bibliography has two entries by the Mormon Stephen Covey. My conclusion? Lutheran writers, thinkers, and advocates for a pervasively Christian view of vocation have far from exhausted their welcome. In the discussion among Christian business professionals, Bill Deal's name stands out, but there could be so many more. And the role of this newly established center is potentially very significant. My personal experience, anecdotally thin as it is, suggests that Lutherans have not been quietistic in their approach to the theology of work, but have been perhaps isolated and bound by a historic reticence to engage other Christian groups, including those not tied directly to church or denominational structures. True apocalypticism is about hope, not doom. The times they are changing, and as Trueblood noted in The Glare of Hiroshima, only a Christian frame of reference can give church and society the necessary stability. And so, Uwe, may the Institute for Lay Vocation play a vital role in promoting that vision. Thank you.